Okay. Do you have your nameplate with you? Just put it up in front. I mean, obviously, starting next session, if you can bring it with you, that'll be great. If you don't have a nameplate, just take a card, write your name, put it in front. No, it'll help kind of when I call on you. Before I get started, how many of you are in my corporate finance class? I see quite a few familiar faces. Okay. How many of you are undergraduates? Okay. Yeah, MBAs are saying, oh my God, there are undergraduates in this room. Don't worry, you know, they're not going to contaminate you, an undergrad, don't worry. They don't know that much more than you do. They just look like they do. Okay? So in case you're in the wrong class, might as well get that out of the way right off the front. This is valuation. Okay? And actually, it is my 52nd semester teaching valuation. So it's been quite a ride. In fact, when I came to NYU in 1986, I was given a class to teach. It was called Security Analysis. For those of you who know the history of this class, it has a very long tradition. It's the class that Ben Graham taught at Columbia, that you know who, he who should not be named, kind of took in the 1950s. And that's the class they gave me. And I took one look and said, I'm not teaching this class. Because it's a collection of topics. By the time you got to 1986, it showed its age. So there were like 3 weeks on stocks and 2 weeks on bonds and 1 week on options and 1 week on futures and 7 weeks on institutional details. You know what those were? That the listing requirements of the New York Stock Exchange. Teaching was so easy before Wikipedia. Because you just take off lists and spend the entire session, item one, item two. I mean, we've taken our share of classes like that. And I said, I'm not teaching this class, which is not a great attitude to take if you've just been hired as an assistant professor. So I went to the head of my department and said, I'd like to teach a valuation class. And he said, don't do it. There isn't enough stuff in valuation to fill a class. And in 1986, he was absolutely right. There wasn't enough stuff in valuation to fill two sessions. Forget about a class. In fact, when I did my MBA, I think we spent over the two-year program, maybe 2 hours on valuation. And what I was taught was called the Gordon Growth Model. You know what the Gordon Growth Model is? It's a stable growth dividend discount model. That's all you need. It's cruel and unusual punishment to turn people loose in the world with the Gordon Growth Model, because, as I've described it before, using the Gordon Growth Model to... If I use the Gordon Growth Model, stable growth dividend discount model, to value Google, what's the value of Google? How much does Google pay in dividends? Nothing. You put nothing in the numerator, the value is nothing. Okay, let's move on, right? Okay. This will make life incredibly simple for you, because all you'd be valuing are what? Banks on the verge of bankruptcy, which are still paying dividends. Don't ask me why. And some really big utilities. But I really, really wanted to teach this valuation class. And I considered two options. One was the academic official permission option. You know how that works. You go and ask for permission to teach this class, and then a committee will meet. And they will report to another committee, which will report to a third committee, which will report back to the second committee. And by the time you get approval, you'll be 65. So I said very quickly, no, I'm not doing that. And I decided early on in my academic life that the only way to get things done at a university was to do them subversively. So I said, you want me to do security analysis? I'd be glad to. And I went into the classroom and taught a valuation class. They have no idea what I do in this role. Even with the webcast, nobody there watches it. I could be teaching cooking for all you know, for 25 sessions and call it whatever I wanted. You know how long it took them to find out? In 2008, 22 years after I start teaching this class, I get a call from the dean's office saying, we hear you're teaching a valuation class. And I said, yes, I've been doing it for 22 years. So we should call it valuation. I said, okay. Sounds like a good idea. In fact, if you look at the Stern schedule, valuation shows up for the first time in 2008. That's because before that I used to hijack other classes and make them valuation classes. Equity, instruments, and markets. I don't care about instruments. Markets bore me, so I taught a valuation class. So that's how this class's history is developed. But it's always been a valuation class. So what I'd like to do actually today is lay the foundations for what we're going to do in this class, and it's going to be very simple. You know what we're going to do in this class? Talk about valuation, still more valuation, and even more valuation. Which means if you're not that interested in valuation, this is probably not the class for you. Okay? There's enough stuff in valuation now to fill a class. Okay? So let me start off with the administrative details. To find me, just go up to the 9th floor. You see an apple on my door. It's 996. Knock, and if I'm there, I'll open the door, or maybe I won't. Right? Easiest way to get to me is my email. Is to email me. Don't tweet me. Don't Facebook me. I'm not in the mood for social media interaction on this class specifically. Easiest to email me. My homepage, and I'll come back and talk about this because this is going to be a central clearinghouse for this class, is just mylastname.com. I bought my own last name and it was cheap. People keep offering to sell me my own name back to me. Like somebody tried to sell me aswadhamodaran.com and asked me for $10,000. I said, it's not worth that much. You can keep it, right? So that's going to be my main website, but it's easy to get lost. So I'll kind of show you which portion of the website you should stay in before you get wandering off. Okay? The office hours for this class are right before my corporate finance class, which is 10:30 to 11:50, and right after. It doesn't sound like a lot of office hours, but there's a simple reason for that. The best time to catch me is not during my office hours. It sounds incredibly crazy, but that's the way it is. Because during my office hours, I'm getting ready for class, people have questions, it's tough to get questions answered. So you remember the fair game principle if you were in my corporate finance class? Somebody help me out. What's the fair game principle? You've forgotten already?
We catch you anywhere.
If you find me, I'm fair game. So the game already starts. Over the next 15 weeks, my job is to make sure you don't catch me. Okay? So I take the stairs. I try to avoid all the things that that MBAs and undergraduates, now I have to add the undergraduates to the list, don't like to do and do them. Okay? But if you do catch me, no matter where it is, I'm fair game. About questions related to the class, not about spiritual concerns. Those you can talk to somebody else. So that's the best time. Just come in. I'm usually around pretty much every weekday. I keep academic hours, which means I come in when I want, I leave when I want. And sometimes I don't come in at all. I never come in before 9, I guarantee you that. I don't stay after 4:30. I have this thing about not being in my office when the sun goes down. I'm afraid I might turn into a werewolf or a vampire or something, so I'm gone. So between 9 and 4:30, I'm pretty much around every weekday, so catch me then. There are two teaching assistants for this class. The names are listed there. I will send you more information on their office hours. But a note of warning, they have nothing to do with the grading in this class. I grade your quizzes. I grade your exams. If you have a problem, bring it to me. Don't bring it to the TAs. They will run weekly sessions primarily for those people who have a numbers problem. You know what I'm talking about? They're afraid of numbers. I mean, let's face it. You've been a liberal arts major. It's been a long time since you saw a number. Right? You could go 7 years without ever seeing a number, right? Literature, history, sociology, maybe even psychology. So what you have is a numbers problem. And sometimes that manifests itself as a valuation problem. I don't know how to use my calculator, or I don't know how to do this. They will run weekly sessions kind of, you know, working with just pragmatic stuff if you have a numbers problem. So let me lay out the class. This is a class, I said, about valuations. How much stuff is there in valuation? This is about all types of valuation. I don't have an agenda here, but I'm going to sell you on a particular way of doing valuation. So I'm going to talk about different ways of thinking about value, starting with what everybody tends to think of when they think about value, which is intrinsic value or discounted cash flow model. And I'll make a confession. It's the way I prefer to think about valuation, so it's where we're going to spend the most time. We're going to spend more than half the class on intrinsic valuation. And you're going to be surprised at what you find out about what you thought about DCF valuation. I don't know whether any of you had a chance to check out the blog post I put yesterday, but when you get a chance, go and read it, because it kind of lays that philosophical foundation for what this class is about, what it can do and what it cannot do. I also want to talk about what I'll call relative valuation, but what I actually should be called pricing. I'm going to make this statement up front, and I'll come and back this up later, that 90% of what passes for valuation out there, you know what I mean by out there, on Wall Street, is really not valuation, it's pricing. And you say, what's the difference? That's one of the things I want to talk about. There is a difference. So when you tell me you want to value something, my first question is, are you sure you want me to value this, or what do you want me to price it? And it leads to very different ways of thinking about how you come up with that number. So we will spend about 5 or 6 sessions on pricing. If it sounds mysterious, anytime you see a multiple in comparables, people are pricing. There's nothing more, nothing less. We'll talk about how to do it right, because there's a lot of how to do it wrong that you see played out there. And third, we will talk a little bit about how you can apply option pricing in the context of valuation. This is what falls under the rubric of real options. I'm a skeptic on it. I think people often oversell it, but I think it has a place, but a very small place. So we'll talk about different valuation approaches. We'll talk about valuing all kinds of companies. This is not just about valuing large publicly traded companies, because the reality is you don't need a class for that. 15 minutes, I can teach you all you need to do. You might already know it, how to value a public. In fact, I don't even think I need a person. You could probably automate the whole thing. If every company you were valuing was a Coca-Cola, this class would be a waste of time. You don't need much in terms of valuation tools to value mature money-making companies. So we're going to value companies across the life cycle, from young growth all the way to on the verge of death. Companies that are kind of kicking the bucket, not tipping it over, seeing what happens, the whole spectrum. We're going to value companies which are both public and private companies, private businesses, small private businesses, right? We're going to value companies across markets. Okay? So it's actually absurd to talk about. We're going to talk about developed market companies now. I'll go back and forth. I mean, so I'll be valuing a developed market company, and then 15 minutes later, we'll be valuing an emerging market company, a public company, a private business, because, again, I think the principles stay the same. It's an incredibly versatile tool, and you can apply it in any kind of company. So we're going to look at valuations across all kinds of businesses. We might slip in a few odds and ends. If I get a chance, I want to talk about valuing something like the Arian Foster tracking stock. Did you hear about this? You know who Arian Foster is? He's a running back for the Houston Texans. And about 2 years ago, this company created a security you could buy where you could buy a share of Arian Foster's earnings. You can extend it. If you're a soccer fan, think about buying a share of Messi's earnings or, you know, And it's not just his earnings as an athlete, it's endorsement earnings as well. They sold shares, and the question is, how much would you pay for those shares? You say, you can't do that. That's valuing a person. Well, you're walking on the very edge of, you know, what's legal and ethical, but in a sense, you're buying a share of cash flows. So if I get a chance, I'll talk about it. We might talk about Bitcoin somewhere along the way. Can Bitcoin be valued? What's the because everything is fair game. Everything has a number to attach to it. The question is, how do you come up with the number? I also want to talk about valuation from different perspectives. You're saying, what do you mean? I want to talk about valuation of a company as an investor looking at the company. But that's not the only way to think about valuation. What if you're a manager in a company thinking about value? What's different? What if you're an activist investor thinking about changing a company? What if you're a portfolio manager? What if you're an analyst? So different perspectives, how they might change your views on value. And also, I want to talk about what you can do to change value. In an acquisition, changing the way a company is run, restructuring. So in a sense, everything is fair game. And when everything is fair game, you can see valuation is going to play a role in no matter what you do. At this stage in your MBA life or your undergraduate life, if you're a senior, you're looking at, you probably already know where you're going to be working, I hope. But if not, sometime during the semester. Hopefully you will find a place for valuation no matter what you decide to do. So with that set up, here's the way the class is going to be set up. We're going to spend the first two sessions setting the table. We talked about the three different approaches to valuation. I'm going to give you the big picture perspective and how they differ and why they might lead to different valuations. Then we're going to spend about 12 sessions delving, getting into the weeds, delving into the details of intrinsic valuation. I'm going to, the reason I call it intrinsic valuation rather than discounted cash flow valuation is the minute you say discounted cash flow valuation or the acronym DCF, people already have preconceptions about what it is, and often those preconceptions are so horribly wrong that I'd prefer you think about intrinsic value first and DCF as a way of estimating that intrinsic value. Okay? Then about 15 to 18, we're going to talk about multiples, earnings multiples, book value multiples, revenue multiples, EBITDA multiples. And I'm going to give you a very simple framework for demystifying multiples. In other words, if I told you that a stock is cheap because it's trading at 5x earnings, then I gave you three questions. What are the three questions? So no matter what the multiple is, what are the questions you need to ask to make sure that that company is in fact cheap rather than a company that just looks cheap? I'm going to draw a contrast. Lots of companies look cheap. There are relatively few companies that are cheap. And the essence of relative valuation is to be able to separate the companies that are truly cheap from the ones that just look cheap. And I want to talk about for four sessions, we'll talk about applying option pricing in the context of valuation. Sounds mysterious at the moment, but I'm not going to take you back to pricing options. I don't care about pricing individual options. It's a different class for it. This is about valuing businesses using option pricing. And then the last two sessions of the class are really about applying this in very specific contexts. One is in the value of acquisitions. There's nothing really special about valuing an acquisition. But there might be a couple of things that make it different in terms of how you apply evaluation tools. I personally don't see, if you asked me to teach an M&A class after two sessions, I'd be out of material. Because the reality is most M&A classes are about the deal-making part of the process. I have zero interest in that. You can learn it elsewhere. This is about the valuation part, and guess what? If you overpay for a deal, I don't care how well you structure the deal and what kind of target company you pick, the deal is sunk. I think too little attention is paid to value in acquisitions. So I'm going to come back and talk about how to do valuation right in acquisitions. And in the 25th session, I want to talk a little bit about if you are the manager of a company. I've just hired you as CEO of McDonald's. Position is open, right? You're now the CEO. What would you do to increase value of the company? You're going to see it's easier in some companies than in others, but that's really what value enhancement is about. Now that you're on the inside, with access to all the levers, what would you do to change the value of the company? The last session, we'll kind of pull this all together and try to make sure that everything fits. Now, this is too late for pre-season prep, but I did send you these links ahead of time in case you felt a little worried about this class. There are three basic tools or skills that you need to do this class. One is accounting, not in the sense of understanding debit and credit. I couldn't care less. But you need to be able to read a financial statement. And in fact, when I say read a financial statement, if I asked you to get the operating income for a firm, I don't want you to say, no, what's the difference between operating income and net income? So those basic financial statement analysis tools are critical, because I don't like financial statements, but that's where you get the raw data to do your valuation. Second, very basic statistics. So when I talk about the variance, I want you to at least have a sense of what exactly, the covariance or the correlation. Very minimalist, that stat 101, the first three sessions. I might even draw on your multiple regression and simple regression skills, which are long since rusted. But don't worry, we'll kind of bring up just what we need to do that. Right? And in terms of finance tools, it is, if you haven't taken corporate finance already, it's not actually a prereq for this class yet, really, then I would suggest that you go back and review my corporate finance sessions on this, so you can go and look at basic present value, risk and return. Not because we won't do it again here, but we'll do it in a rush here. And you're going to say, that went by really fast. So in terms of pre-class prep, that's what I need you to think about. So if you feel uncomfortable about your basics, I have primers on my website. They're not long. They're about 8 to 10 pages that give you essentially everything you need to know on each of these topics before we jump in. Those of you in my corporate finance class know the harassment has already started. You've already got 3 emails. We didn't even meet yet. But that's just the beginning. Basically, starting today, for the rest of this semester, you'll get an email a day. You can view that as a threat or a promise, but that's pretty much what you can get. Let me take that back. During the break, I will give you 1 week off. No emails, but it just takes a huge amount of willpower on my part not to send an email out right in the middle of break. So here's how the class is going to be structured. Obviously, we'll start with class on Monday. Right after this class, maybe an hour after the class, you'll get an email saying, this is what we did today. Saying, we did it today. Why do I need an email? Because let's face it, you know, you might be here physically, but mentally you might be in Hawaii or wherever you were before you came. You're saying, I wish I was there again. This is saying, it's okay. You know, this is what we did. You didn't miss very much. You know, there'll be an email that follows the class. Tomorrow, I will put up a valuation of the week. You're saying, what the heck is that? Okay. Basically, each week I will put up a valuation of a company that I will do, and I'll take you through the framework, and I would like you to try your hand at valuing the company. And I know part of you is already screaming, but we just started the class. I don't know how to do valuation. Don't worry. I'll do all the hard work. All you have to do is go tweak a number. In fact, I've put up the valuation of the week for this week already online. Anybody check it out yet? It's a valuation. It's a crowd valuation of Uber that I did in December on my blog that I put up. And essentially what you're all, how many of you use Uber? Okay, so everybody knows what Uber does. It's been obviously in the news. So what I mean by a crowd valuation of Uber, it's about the value you attach to Uber is very much a function of the story you tell about Uber. Get used to that, because you came into this class, you thought, no storytelling, that's the strategy. Strategy is storytelling without an end. This is storytelling with an objective. So the value that you attach to Uber will be a function of the story you tell about the company. You're saying, like what? If you tell me that Uber is a car service company, which basically means it's competing for the cab business, the limo business, primarily in urban areas, the value that you're going to get for Uber is about $15 billion. And as you probably read in the news, the most recent VC investment put it at 41, which means those guys are expecting to go public at about 75. You don't put in 41 expecting to get 45 back, you want the upside. So you're saying, how do I explain what the 75? First rule to remember in valuation is never try to explain what other people pay. It's not your job. It's not your responsibility. If they want to explain why they paid 75, that's their business. But you say, well, how can they come up with $75 billion? It's easy. If you call Uber a transportation company, see the difference? We're a transportation company. What's the market you're competing for? It's not just a car service company. It could be the rental car business. It could be the moving business, logistics. It could even be the fact that I drove my second car to the train station through the snow and the slush today, parked it, and guess what it's doing all day? It's just sitting there. And when I get home, I've got to shovel the snow off the thing and hope it starts up again and get home. It's an absurd waste. If you think about, your apartment is empty all day, right? I hope. Maybe somebody's broken in already, but but there's an incredible amount of excess capacity here. It's silly to buy a second car for, what, 20 minutes of driving every day. So you see how Uber might potentially go after this market? They say, well, maybe you don't need a second car. In which case, your potential market is much bigger. The value for Uber is could be $90 billion. So it's actually, try it, because at each stage ask you a question. Well, what's the potential market for? And you have to pick. You have to say, I think it's a car service company, it's a logistics company, it's a transportation company. Leave the rest to me. Then I ask you, does it have local networking benefits or global networking benefits? You think, what the heck does that even mean? Local networking benefit means that if you become the biggest car service company in a city, then when I want to call a car, I'm more likely to call you. You see why? Because if you have 60% of the cars, it's much more likely that a car is close by if you... So that's a local networking benefit. And if you have local networking benefits, your market share in a particular city is going to go towards 60, 70, 80%, but you get no benefits in other cities. So the fact that you're the largest player in San Francisco doesn't provide you with an advantage in London. But if you have global networking benefits, here's what it takes. So here's the form it takes. You get off in Jakarta, you look at your phone, say, well, I have an Uber app on my phone. It's so much easier to use Uber, and you hit the Uber app. Then you get global networking benefits. Do you see why this matters? Every piece of your story affects a number. If you pick local networking benefits, their end market share is going to be maybe 10, 12%. They're going to be fighting these fights in every city with other providers. It doesn't have to be Lyft. It could be somebody new. But if they get global networking benefits, they get a tipping point, which is they get to 30%. It's like Google. You won the game already. So I ask you, do you think, and when you give me the answer, I pick a market share. Then I ask you, what kind of competitive advantages do you think Uber has? And if you say strong and sustainable, I leave the margins high. If you say, well, it's strong right now, but it's not sustainable, I bring the margins down. If you say it's weak, I give you much lower margins. So what I do at each step is I ask you just to tell me what you think about the story. And as I said, initially, I'll do the number crunching in the background. But at the end, you're going to get a valuation of Uber that is your valuation based on the choices you made. And if you don't like that number, guess what? You don't like your own story. That's basic. So this week's valuation of the week is about connecting numbers to stories, something I'm going to come back to over and over in this class. But if you try it, then maybe you'll start to get comfortable. So next week, I'll pick a different. So every Tuesday, I'll put a valuation of the week. I'll try to jump all over the world, all kinds of businesses. Okay? So next week, I might put up Severstal, which is a Russian steel company. Maybe I'll slip in a Greek bank in there. Hey, might as well deal with the fiasco as you go along. So, again, the point is you're going to get 14 different valuations of the week, each of which are in a different kind of company. I'll provide the spreadsheet with my valuation. Initially, you might just change the fifth decimal point because you don't feel that confident. That's okay. But then as you get more confident, you say, I don't like your growth rate. That's where I want you to be. I want you to be in a place where you say, I don't like your risk. I don't like your risk measure. I don't like your growth rate. I don't like your cash flow. Maybe that'll happen in the seventh week, the third week, or the 14th week. But the minute you're able to do that, I know my job is done. Okay? Because that's really what valuation is about. It's not about the right value, but understanding what it is that drives value. So every Tuesday, I'll put up a valuation of the week. I'll give you a week to kind of deal with it. There'll be a Google shared spreadsheet. Where you take, so basically I list the five parameters for Uber on the market share, and then you just go across, fill in what you chose and the value that you got. What I'd like to see for the week one is I'd like to see, there are 120 people in the class, I'd like to see 120 names on that Google Shared spreadsheet next week. And some of your values might be very close to mine, and some might be very different. That's okay. Okay. So, you're saying, how does this affect my grade? Not at all. What will happen if you never do a valuation of the week? Nothing. But if you want to really learn valuation, this is how you do it. You get your hands dirty with different types of companies. You play with the numbers. Initially, that's all you're doing is playing with the numbers. But the more you work with the numbers, the more you'll recognize what it is that drives value. So that'll be Tuesday. Wednesday, you will get... class, you get the email, and that's Wednesday email, I will send you a weekly challenge. What is this? Basically, I take what we did that week and take it, you know, who's that guy? Is it Kick It Up a Notch? I'll Kick It Up a Notch, that chef, yeah, coach, the chef Emerald. So basically, I'll kick it up a notch. Basically, I'll give you something that takes what we did and say, let's see if you can take it to the next level. And I'll give you until Sunday to turn it in. And again, nothing will happen to you if you don't turn it in. But to the extent that you want to try it, just jump in. Each week you'll get, there'll be, I think, 12 weekly challenges over the, I'll skip it when you have other stuff coming to you. Okay. On Thursday, I'll send you an email about your project. You're saying, what project? Don't worry, I'll tell you. It'll take over your life for the next 15 weeks. So it'll just be a nagging email saying, this is where you're supposed to be. Where are you? And then let the guilt kind of work its way up to the top. For some of you, you're immune to this. So nothing will happen till the 14th week, the day before the project is due. But for some of you, the guilt will start eating away at you. So this is my nagging email. On Friday, I'll put up a webcast. Another webcast. This will be about a 10-minute webcast on something very pragmatic. Like the first week, it's about reading a 10K. You say, I can read a 10K. I learned how to read in fifth grade, or third grade, or second grade, or first grade, or whenever. This is about reading a 10K for evaluation. And what I do is I take the Procter & Gamble 10K. I have my Procter & Gamble evaluation. And I go through the 10K and say, these are the parts of the 10K I'm using. This is why I'm using it, and these are the parts of the 10K that I find useless. So out of the 250 pages in the Procter & Gamble 10K, guess how many pages I end up using? I use about 12. That is really part of the skill set evaluation as well. Knowing what to ignore is almost, it's an even bigger skill than knowing what to count in. We're surrounded by data. In fact, your complaint when you evaluate a company is not that you don't have enough information. It's that you have too much data. I'm going to draw the line between data and you're going to be inundated. You go on Google search, you type in the name of your company. You're going to find thousands of things on your company. You'll have to decide what's a distraction, what doesn't matter, and what does matter. So the first webcast will be, it's about 12 minutes long. It's about taking you through the Procter & Gamble 10K. This is what I used. This is what I did not use. This is why. And each week I'll put up a webcast on whatever the topic is. And next week I might put up one on equity risk premiums and how I estimate them and risk-free rates the week after. So each week there will be something that I kind of focus on that was a skill for that week. But it's really about applying this with real data, real time, real companies. On Saturday you get a weekly newsletter. Don't expect a lot of news. It's not sensational news. There'll be nothing about Kim Kardashian in there. But this is a newsletter that tells you what we did during the course of that week, where we are in the class, and where we plan to go next week. Think of it as a moving GPS. That's all it is. It's really about, because there will be points in this semester, and I'm realistic on it, where life will get in the way of this class. Okay? Other classes I'm not worried about. They're all minor classes anyway, but life will get in the way. You have something big. You have a brother's wedding, somebody graduating. That week you had to take off. That will happen to each and every one of you. This is just a kind of say, if it happens, don't freak out. I'll tell you where you are. You haven't lost your place in the class. So it's very short. So if you get a chance, read the newsletter. About half the people by the fifth week just don't read it. I don't care. I just keep churning it out. Right? On the Sunday, I'll put up the solution to the weekly challenge that I sent you on Wednesday. Incidentally, these weekly challenges will stay online through the entire semester. So if somewhere in the sixth week, you have this moment of clarity where you say, you know what, I should be doing these weekly challenges, you can go back and do them all right from the beginning. So including the evaluations of the week. So those Google shared spreadsheets will stay open for the entire semester. So that's the sequence for the class. The rules for the class are relatively few. Okay? Be here, try to be on time. Though it's not. I'd rather that you're here late than not at all. So if you're 20 minutes late, I have a very high threshold for distraction. So if you walk in with a big pizza on your head, I won't even see you. Okay? So don't worry about distracting me. You might distract other people in the class, but that's their problem, not mine. So, I'd rather that you're here than not here. And the reason I say that is I will make it very easy for you to not be here. And I want you to kind of overcome that very... So in a sense, I'll throw everything at you and say, now do you want to still keep coming? How about right now? I keep pushing this every semester to see how far I can go before people stop coming. Okay? One of these days, nobody's going to show up. Then I know I've reached the end. Right? Bring your lecture note packet with you. I don't know whether the bookstore has the packets yet. But the only reason for you to use the bookstore is because you feel you have too much money and you just want to throw it away. The PDF version of the lecture notes are online. You can download them and just read them on your iPad if you want. My recommendation is that you print them off, but don't use the printer downstairs because they get really mad at me when people keep printing off my lecture note packets in big stacks. Right? There are 700 pages in the 3 lecture note packets. Right? Don't worry, we'll get through all 700 slides, but bring the lecture notes with you because every slide you see in this class will be in that packet. And I don't want frenetic note-taking in this class. You know what I'm talking about? Some people, the only way they can stay awake is to take on every word that's said. I am not that profound. There's nothing I say that you're going to miss some huge thing. So have the lecture notes, put your notes on the side, everything's going to be okay. And if you do miss a class, as I said, I do make it easy for you to miss a class. I don't like you to, but I understand that you came here for an MBA, not because you like the intellectual challenge but because you wanted a better job. Which means that part of it also has to play in there. So you get that big interview, I understand. You got to go to that interview. Okay? So the classes will be available in lots of different places. You can, of course, there'll be a stream of the class which will go on about an hour and a half after the class. You just click on the link, you'll be able to watch the class. I'll also make downloadable video and audio files of these classes. This is in case you're not connected to broadband, you want to have the class so you can watch it while you're exercising, God help you, but whatever you're doing, or while you're jogging, so people do strange things. But I'll have them as downloadable files. I'll also create YouTube versions of these classes. The advantage of YouTube is it adjusts the file size to whatever your connection is. So if you have a really slow connection, it'll make it a smaller file, which is an advantage you don't get with the downloadable stuff because you can be waiting for a long time. And what about books? I have too many books on valuation. Okay. I have 4 of them, actually. Okay. The only one that's a standard textbook is Investment Valuation. That's the one that I suggest to you. Standard textbook in what sense? At the end of every chapter, there are problems, the things you're supposed to do in a textbook. And I hate writing standard textbooks because of all the things you have to do. But as a textbook, that's probably the best suited for this class. But the other 3 books will do fine. The Modern Evaluation is actually it's written for practitioners, but mostly practitioners who are involved in dealing with control and synergy and all those, what I call the loose ends and valuations. It's focused on that. The Dark Side of Valuation is actually my favorite book. It's about valuing companies that are difficult to value. This is really the only reason we have this class. So it's about valuing young companies, cyclical companies, commodity companies, companies that give us trouble. And if you really are budget constrained, the little book of valuation is really little and it's cheap. It's only 200 pages. And all of the books kind of deliver the same message. And you can actually live without any of them because some of them are obscenely overpriced. And if you really feel you can't afford it, you'll be fine. Yeah. So, because you can find whole sections of the book online anywhere, just keep clicking. Somewhere on the website, you find a link to portions of the book or the entire book. Yeah, just don't let the world know. I do have a valuation app for an Apple device. So if you have an iPad or an iPhone, I have a valuation app. So, if you want to download it, you're welcome to. If you have Android, I don't have one because it's really writing an app for a smartphone. You actually have to start from scratch. You can't tweak an existing app. And this app, because we give it away, essentially cost us probably $25,000-$30,000. And we're in no mood to spend another $30,000. If you have a BlackBerry, you don't even hold your breath. It's nothing's happening. Android, maybe that in the long term I'll get around to it. BlackBerry, because it'll probably die as a technology before I get around to it anyway. So, So if you have a BlackBerry, tough. Right? Now, in terms of staying connected, the website for this class is the starting point. So let me just click on the website. So this is what it looks like. Actually, I spent those of you who remember my website from Corporate Finance, it was set in the 90s. I've at least moved it to 2003 now. There's no Java, nothing of that stuff, but at least it's not as clunky as it was. So this is for the class. Basically, it lists out the class. It lists the syllabus and the projects will be there. Every exam and quiz I've ever given in evaluation class, that's 52 semesters worth of exams and quizzes, are online. Okay? The newsletters will be there. Every email I send for this class will go into a big file, so you have no excuse for saying I didn't get that email. It's there. So this is my way of taking away any excuses. I never saw that. No, it's there. The lecture notes you can get right off here. So the PDF files you can download as a PDF file and print it off. The spreadsheets you might use. We have practice prompts. Comparable firm data. I'll have to talk about what to do because that link might not be working right now because I'm having a few issues with the data providers who seem to think I've become competition. There are readings for this class, which for the extra time you clearly will have. You can add to those readings. Most of them are from the Wall Street Journal, Fortune, Forbes. They're not readings in the conventional sense where I'm going to ask you to read an academic article. Data and data links you can check out. The class webcast will be right here, as will every company that I value in this class. I'll put up the Excel spreadsheet in there so you can go and tweak the numbers and see what you get as a value. Now the second place you can follow this class, and this every semester I've taken to finding one young startup in this educational technology space and trying them out, because I get at least one call every 3 days from somebody who started some new thing, and they know I'll experiment. So this semester I'm experimenting with this site called YellowDig, which is a Wharton-based, but don't hold it against them. No, somebody from Wharton started it. But it's really a combination of a class and a social media site. So basically you can go in and, so I'll put my sessions up there and you can talk about what we talked about in the session. You can throw in tangents, you can throw in links, you can do whatever you want. But give it a shot. I'm not going to force anybody to be on there. The last thing I want to do is force people to be on social media as if you're not already on social media all the time. But if you feel that this is a place where you can contribute and be part of a discussion, try it out. Tell me how it works. As I said, my objective is to provide feedback to these people on what works and what doesn't. And that site is actually open to anybody with an EDU site. So actually the class is being taken by people at 50 different universities who will all be tracking the class while you're taking it. So you might get a comment from somebody at Wharton or Harvard that's incredibly ill-informed, and you can set them right. Make you feel a lot better, right? If you have an Apple device, or even if you have an Android, you can also take the class on iTunes U. iTunes U is an app for the Apple, but if you have an Android, there's a version of it that you can set up, where essentially you'll see the class delivered through the app. It's actually a very neat interface because all the classes are lined up. You get notifications the minute I post a webcast or when I post something on there. So again, if you have an Apple device, you can try that. If none of those work for you, I've created a playlist on YouTube for just this class. All the sessions will go in there. The problem with YouTube is it's great for delivering video, but everything else, it's kind of a pain in the neck. I can't attach a file to a YouTube. And I was in Google last week, and I was saying, how come you don't allow attachments to YouTube video? Wouldn't that be neat? I don't think they're going to react right away and tell me on Monday they changed the whole process and let me attach things. But you can at least get the webcast. And there's more. There's a Google Calendar for the class, which I, finally wised up, and rather than put the entire Google link there, which is like 3 lines long, I've created a kind of condensed link. So that actually lists everything in this class, when it's coming due. So there will be no surprises in this class. When the quizzes are due, when the project is due, everything is in fact lined up there. And if you get a chance, as I said, if you go visit that, go check out the post I put up yesterday. It's going to be part of something. As I post on that, it'll almost always have something to do with valuation. Okay. So right now I'm working on a piece that I thought of yesterday while I was watching Shark Tank with my kid. And have you seen Shark Tank? I'd strongly recommend this as part of your weekly. It's a great show to start thinking about valuation. Okay? And don't wait for Kevin to jump in and do stupid royalty thing. You can, or Mark Cuban to say, it's worth $5 million. What I wanted to think about as that pitch is made is, how would I value this business? What are the questions I would need answers to? Now, because that's really what valuation is, taking that story that that person is saying and attaching it to a number. I know many of these are young businesses, but that's exactly where valuation has the most impact. So I'm working on a piece on when they say they want 30% of the company, are they talking about pre-money valuations and post or post-money valuations? It's a conversation I had with my 16-year-old son. He said, Dad, shut up. I want to watch the show. But it's pre-money, post-money is used so casually in the venture capital space that I think it is misused. So I want to do a post. So those are the kinds of things I post in the blog. It's really got to do with what we do in the class. So if you get a chance, as all of you know, from my corporate finance class, my end game is to become the Lady Gaga of finance. So basically, if you can go add your email addresses, multiple ones if need be, to my Twitter account and push my numbers up. Frankly, I don't care if you ever read my tweets. I just want the numbers. So if you have a dog that has a Twitter account, add the dog on. Cat, not a problem. Rat, I don't care, right? So I'm just looking to push my numbers up right now, so just help me out there. Right? In terms of grading, this is an unpleasant part of every class. Here's what I'm looking for, and I'll have to figure out ways to do it. If by the end of this class you can value just about anything, I think you deserve an A in this class. Anything. So if I came to whatever it is, you say, I can do it. So if you've gotten to that level, I want to make sure you get an A. If you can value most things, then I think you're up to the B, B plus. If you can value some things, that's not doing very much, then you're a C. If you can value nothing by the end of this class, then I think I failed miserably. Okay, hopefully none of you will be in that status of I couldn't value anything at the start of the class, I can't value anything right now, because that's a waste of time and money. And here's how I propose to attach that grade to your name. There'll be a project that runs through the entire semester, which is a group project, and I'll describe it in a few minutes as to how big the groups can be, what exactly is group about it. And that project is worth 30%, and it's due in two parts. A portion of the project is due midway through the semester, and the entire project is due on May 11th. Now, for those of you in my corporate finance class, I never ask for a mid-semester. The reason I do that is, how many of you are second-year MBAs again? There's this risk of premature graduation. You've heard of this phenomenon where people in March think they've graduated already? So it's often a problem getting work done in April and May. So to prevent that premature graduation that kicks in for second-year MBAs, kind of make that hook of, show me something before you have that problem of not being able to work anymore. So it's due in two parts. The April 3rd submission is not graded. It's more for feedback, and I'll explain in a minute. But that's a 30% project. There's a second project that's a mystery project. You're saying, what's it about? It's a mystery. That's why it's a mystery project. It could be a breakup of a company. It could be Shake Shack. If that had been the company going public at that time, so value this. So it can be whatever it is, something in the news, something that forces you to try to. So those are both group projects. Okay. Now, in terms of individual work, in case the system we have, the quizzes are individual. So in case you have a cultural thing where you feel you work in groups better, this is not the time to show me that that can happen. Okay. There'll be three quizzes. They will be at the start of session 9, 16, and 22, in the first 30 minutes of each of those classes. I want to emphasize, first 30 minutes, so don't come in 15 minutes late on those days. That's half the quiz right there. They're open book, open notes. And as I said, every quiz I've ever given is online, which actually raises an interesting paradox for me or challenge for me, because if every quiz I've ever given is online and it's open book, open notes, you know what that means about the quiz you will get this semester. It's got to be different. So every semester I wake up with this recurring nightmare that maybe this is the semester I will not be able to throw a twist in that you've never seen before. I haven't run out of twists yet, but maybe this will be the semester that it happens. But it's open book, open notes, 30 minutes, first 30 minutes. Each quiz is worth 10%. Okay? There'll be a final exam. It's already scheduled for May 13th, which is the Wednesday. Last class is on Monday. It's 2 days later. So just keep that in mind as you prepare, because if you wait till after the last class to prepare, there's lots of stuff coming at you. It's from 1:30 to 3:30 on May 13th. I put these rules up in my corporate finance class because there's nothing more contested than quizzes in terms of people say, I didn't quite understand what you wanted. So I want to be very clear about how this will work. There will be no wiggle room on those quiz dates. It's those days, those times. There is no, so even if you have the biggest interview on the face of the earth, I cannot do a makeup quiz because of the size of the class. Second, there will be open book, open notes, and each is worth 10%. If you have to miss a quiz for good reason, and I've listed the good reasons, you know, on my website, so you can go check them out. Good reasons could be that you're sick, your spouse is sick, your child is sick, you've gone insane, your subway train got stuck, in which case I'll check the MTA schedules if need be to do. But if you have a good reason, then you can miss the quiz, but here's what will happen. If you miss the quiz, that 10% will always get moved to what's left in the class. Now, I have to do that, right? Because otherwise you get strategic quiz missing. What that means is you do really well in the first two quizzes. By missing the third quiz, you can make the first two get weighted more. So to prevent that, it's always going to move to what's left in the class. So you really don't pay a price in terms of missing a quiz except for one small cost, which is if you take all three quizzes, I will take your worst quiz and move the score on that worst quiz to the average score on the remaining two quizzes in the final. So as an example, let's say you get a 10, a 10, a 0, and a 30. That's the extreme scenario. So you did three perfect exams and you completely blew one exam. You don't even know what happened. Here's what I will do. I will take the 0 and replace it with a 10 because you got 100% on the remaining quizzes. So what I do is I compute the percentage score and everything other than your worst quiz, and I attach it to the worst quiz. But that option you have only if you take all of the quizzes. So it's a little sweetener to try to take all of the quizzes if you can, but if you miss a quiz, it's not the end of the world. You just lose that option. Okay? And you can never be worse off taking all the quizzes. So I will check your score to make sure that it's not lower than you'd have got by missing that third quiz or missing that second quiz. Okay. So that's the administrative stuff. Any questions? Okay. For the quizzes and exams, you can bring in your iPads, partly because your lecture notes might be on iPads, but no open laptops, nothing yet, because that's it. No, I'll have to struggle with that at some point in time as to what to do. Okay. So iPads and iPhones I'm okay with because many of you have your calculators now on your iPads and iPhones. And, but the honor code applies because you have an open iPad. You could be talking to everybody else in the class for all I know. So just keep the honor code in mind. Any questions on the class? Now, the rules of engagement, first on the groups, you have to pick your own groups. Okay. You've got to police your own group. Part of it is I don't want to be the one, so please don't come to me and say, you know, I've got this group member, they're not doing their work. What do you've seen The Godfather, right? Find a pet, find a pillow, pet's head, message delivered. If you don't know what I'm talking about, just watch The Godfather. Horse's head on a pillow, you pretty much get the message. So police your own group. Please don't suck me into your intra-group, whatever. I don't even know what to call it. There'll be one grade per group. So again, I don't want the end to say, that guy did not work. Can you give him a B- and give the rest of us A's? Doesn't work. You either sink together or swim together. Now, I know that some of you are going to have an easier time finding groups than others. In fact, if you're a second year MBA or you're an undergraduate, you know enough people already that you can look around and say, I know enough people here. But if you're an executive MBA, and there are a couple here, if you have a Langone MBA, you are and master's in economics is wanted in, then it's more difficult. So I will create an orphan list. I call this I call it an orphan list. I'll create a Google Shared spreadsheet, orphan list, where you can go in and say, look, you know, I'm an orphan. Please adopt me. Okay, so basically it'll be your name. And basically what I'm hoping for is there are enough orphans that you can adopt each other, kind of collective orphan group. Pathetic little group there, but it might be a way in which you can find somebody rather than my trying. I will not put you in a group because then you know what's going to happen. If that group screws up, they're going to blame me for putting you in there. Okay? So I will create the environment where you'll be able to find a group. And trust me, nobody's ever not found a group in this class. So I'll start that process rolling right after class. On the quizzes, as I said, I grade your quizzes. If you have issues in the quizzes, bring them to me. It's an open, I have an open door on quizzes. I will look at what you have an issue with. I can say yes or no. Don't expect me to make the changes you wanted. But I will make sure that I'm trying to be fair. And as a participation, all participation is welcome, so don't do your internal policing saying she's asking too many questions. Leave that to me. I'll take care of it. Okay? So that's the administrative stuff. Let me close it up. Let me talk a little bit about your projects. Okay. So I want you to already start thinking about two things. One is what your group is going, who else you're going to talk to right after class to be part of a group. Okay? And the second is I want you to start thinking about a company you're going to be valuing. You as an individual, because each person in the group has to pick a company, okay, that you'll be valuing over the course of the semester. It is, I'll be quite honest, the corporate finance class, the group project actually required you to meet as a group. There's very little group work actually in this group project. And that again is a reflection of the fact that I'm a realist. I know that by the time you get to this point in the MBA program, you're sick and tired about the second year MBAs. Or undergrads, you've seen them so much anyway, that you really don't want to interact with them every weekend for the remaining 14 weeks. So there's relatively little group work involved in this process. It's mostly stuff you can do on your own. Portion of the evaluation, as I said, project is going to be due on April 3rd. It's purely for feedback. Okay? So, and the May 11th is when the final project is due. So here's what I'd like you to think about. So if you already have a vision of who's going to be in your group, start thinking about a company to value. And there's a constraint I'm going to add in here. Within your group, at least one company has to be a money-losing company. So find a money-losing company. You'll have no trouble. You know, lots of money-losing companies. At least one company in your group has to have high growth potential in terms of revenue growth. So if you pick Twitter, you've already met one and two already there, right? Money-losing, high-growth company. At least one company has to be a non-US company. And no cheating. Don't use an ADR. I want you to value the non-US company in the local currency, in the local country, because I want you to get comfortable with different currencies. And at least one of these companies has to be a service company, which is, my definition of service is so broad, but Google's a service company. So to me, one company that's not a manufacturing company. So that's a very easy requirement to meet, because 70% of the market. So if you have five people in the group, you have to meet all four constraints. Now, as I said, you could pick one company that meets all the constraints. One money-losing, high-growth, emerging market service company, you're done. So maybe you find that one person who wants to join your group late on, you lay it all on him. You want to do that, then you can be part of our group. But my suggestion is if you really want to understand valuation, pick a difficult company. Don't worry about, will I run into trouble? Trust me, any company can be valued. Any company. Okay? I mean, the challenges you might face might be different for different companies, but pick a company. And there's no real theme that you've got to run across the group. You can pick five different companies in five different sectors in five different markets. So in that sense, it's not like your corporate finance project where I tried to keep you theme-focused. You can do whatever you want. So that's what I want you to start thinking about already, because you can decide to do Shake Shack. It doesn't have to have a history. It went public, so the financials are there. So pick a company, pick something you're interested in, pick something that you might want to invest in. Because valuation is not an intellectual exercise. It's an actionable exercise, which means you want something to come out. In fact, here are the things you're going to do. You're going to do an intrinsic valuation of your company. You're going to tell me a story about your company and show me a valuation. That's the part that's due midway through the semester, is that intrinsic discounted cash flow valuation with your story. And here's what I'm going to get back to you. I'm going to say, the feedback I'm going to give you is maybe this input. So essentially, it's about you fixing or tweaking your valuation. Or you might get an email saying, this looks great, move on. So that's the only reason to send that intermediate portion of the project, is you get the feedback. Okay? Next, you're going to value a company relative to other companies. In other words, you're going to price the company. So if you're looking at a software company, you might price it relative to other software companies. So you have to use multiples and comparables. A social media company against other social media companies. That part, again, you'll use what we did in class to do a value relative to the sector. So you'll have an intrinsic, at this stage, you'll have an intrinsic value for your company, a value relative to the sector. Then I'm going to load up the table and say, why aren't you valued relative to the entire market? You think, what's the difference? I can ask you to value Facebook against other social media companies, and you can come up with a value for Facebook. Then I can ask you to value Facebook against the rest of the U.S. market. You can come up with a different value. I can ask you to value Facebook against a global market, and you can come up with a third value. The values might be very different. So in step four, I'm asking you to do kind of expand your relative valuation, kind of get a sense of why pricing is as much a function of who you compare your company to as it is what tools and techniques you bring to the table. Step five, and this is only for a subset of your companies, when we talk about applying real options, I say maybe your company is a good candidate for using option pricing. Maybe it isn't. If it is, why don't you come up with a value for your company using an option pricing model? So at this stage, if you are one of the unlucky ones where option pricing worked, you will have an intrinsic valuation, a value relative to the sector, a value relative to the market, and a real option valuation for your company. You think, so what? Here's why that might be an issue. Here's what your entire valuation is leading up to. I want you to, at the end of this class, tell me, based on your valuation of the company, whether you'd buy or sell. No weaseling out. No strong buy, semi-strong buy, weak sell. You either buy or sell, right? It's 0-1. Okay. I'll let you hold if you're one of those chicken. In fact, I call it chicken. So buy, sell, and chicken are the three choices I give you. Try not to be a chicken. Make a decision, right? Are you buying or selling? Now it's going to be an issue because you're going to have an intrinsic. See why having five different values is now going to give you a problem? Because what if your intrinsic value is lower than the price, but your relative value is higher than the price? I'm going to make you pick. So which one do you want to hang your hat on? Because that's part of investing as well. Is, are you an intrinsic value person? Are you a pricer? Because then there's nothing right or wrong about one approach. It's what are you trying to do? So that's where this entire process leading up is to that recommendation. So when you're done, you're going to have five different valuations or four different valuations of your company and a recommendation. You're going to have that for each company in your group. So if you have six people in your group, you'll have six companies. The only thing group-wise is when you have to pull these things together. First, the group part is to make sure the constraints get met, that money-losing company. The other is when you pull it all together. But you could probably not get together as a group again until the very last week and kind of pull things together. So don't wait. You don't even have to wait to start a group to pick a company. You can do right after class today, you can pick a company, and here's something to remember. Don't be Hamlet-like. Remember Hamlet, he couldn't make up his mind. There are people who, I can't make up my mind, I can't make up, should I pick this company? Just pick a damn company, and if you don't like it, change it. In fact, what you will learn by doing this one company, you'll find that the process is not wasted because that process is going to be quicker for the second company. So my suggestion is, rather than wait for the perfect company, pick a company for the moment, start the process, because this process will get started on Wednesday. As we start talking about the mechanics, you can already start doing the valuation of your company. Start with the valuation of this company. If you change your mind, you can change your mind. There have been people who have changed their mind 2 days before the final due date. And they're able to pull it off because, in a sense, once you've set up the framework, and that's one of the things I hope you get out of this class, because once you've set up the framework, valuation should never be a six-week exercise. To me, about 3 to 6 hours is the maximum time I'm willing to spend valuing a company. Beyond that, it's mostly wasted time. Now, if I were charging for valuations, of course, I'm going to add another 10 weeks to my process to make it look like I was doing a lot of stuff. But valuation shouldn't be that involved. So that's the objective of this, is to, for you to get your hands dirty trying this. As I said, the mystery project will be somewhere in the 10th, between the 10th and 12th weeks. It will be after the break. And it'll probably be tied around pricing and relative valuation. But I'll let you know, about 2 weeks before the project is due, I'll give you the project. That part will require some group work. So I'll try to make sure you get enough advance notice so that you know when it's coming. Okay? Any questions? Yes. Practically, I think if you get past 6, you're asking for trouble. I don't have a problem with a group of 10, but groups of 10, you're asking for trouble because then you're looking at 10 people's different agendas to keep in line. I'd say 5 to 6, you're probably in good company. If you want to make it a smaller group and go, you need at least 3 people, I think, because to meet those constraints. Right? And the upper limit, if you have a group of 8 that you really want to keep as a group of 8, come and talk to me. And if I'm comfortable with you being able to get together as a group of 8, I'm fine with that. Yeah? Any other questions? Yes. No, you can pick any kind. You can pick a negative earnings company that's on the verge of death,
okay,
with JCPenney, any retailer pretty much, right? And I'm not kidding. You could get Bed Bath & Beyond, Radio Shack. They're all kind of,
so
the
like
knees
that
are...
Company that fits the criteria is fair
use. All you have is your earnings are negative.
Okay.
That's right. Gotcha. So basically, the kind of valuation you'll have to do for a JCPenney will be very different from the kind of valuation you do for a Twitter. They're both money-losing companies, but that's fine. That's a different. I mean, they're different challenges you will face with each one.
Right.
Any other questions? Okay. So this is actually a. This is the only packet that I make copies of because it's a pre-lecture note packet, because I know the first session most people don't even print off the lecture notes. So I'm going to give you kind of a preview of the different valuation approaches. I told you when I came to NYU in 1986 is when I started teaching valuation. And when I first started teaching valuation, I used to think that everybody was as interested in valuation as I was. A huge mistake, because I've discovered in hindsight that most people don't believe in valuation. By most people, I include most people who do valuation for a living, don't believe in valuation. You say, but they do valuation all the time. They do it, but their heart's not quite in it. They do it because it's their job. They do it to cover their rear ends. But if you caught them in an honest moment and asked them, why is Tesla trading at $203 per share? The answer they gave is, because that's what the market thinks it's worth. You scratch the surface. Most people who claim to be value people really are not. They play the pricing game, but they think it sounds better. They tell the world, I am a value investor. And then you throw a Warren Buffett and you read Ben Graham, and all of a sudden you're in the pantheon of value investors. So I'm going to start off by telling you why I do valuation. I do valuation to fight the lemming in me. Just familiar with lemmings? They became famous or infamous in the 1950s when National Geographic filmed a most amazing sight. Thousands of big, ugly, rat-like creatures gathered together on an island, ran right off a cliff into an ocean and committed collective suicide. And ever since, one of those big questions has been, why do they do it? What drives them off the cliff? I don't know the answer to the question, but let's do some virtual imagery. You can see why the first lemming did it, right? He was going too fast. He couldn't stop. Off the cliff, into the ocean. Incidentally, these guys can't swim. That kind of seals the deal. Dead. Second guy into the water as well. Too close to the first guy. But I'd like you to put yourself in the shoes of the very last... I know lemmings don't wear shoes, but kind of hang in there with the analogy anyway. Of the very last lemming in that group. You with me? Beautiful Pacific Island. You're running as fast as you can towards the cliff. You've seen your entire tribe disappear off that cliff. I would assume you'd have second thoughts about what you were just planning to do, right? Your left brain, right brain, whatever parts ration, say, stop, 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 don't do it. But then you hear this voice in the back of your head. You know what it's saying? They must know something that you don't. Remember those 7 deadly words in investing. They must know something that you don't. You know when you hear it? Let's take Tesla. Starstruck. Oh, let's take an even better one. Netflix. What's Netflix trading at right now? 440, something like that?
430.
Best performing stock of the last year. So you sit down to value Netflix. You come up with 150. Let's say you do. What's your rational side say? Don't buy that stock, right? But then the back of your head pipes up. They must know something that you don't. It speaks in a monotone. Don't ask me why. And when you hear that magical thing start to happen to your valuation, your growth rates start to go up, your discount rates start to go down, your cash flows start to get bigger. It's almost like the spreadsheet has taken on a mind of its own. 150 becomes 200, 250, 260, 280, 300. And before you know it, you're at 430, like everybody else. Don't fight it. There's a lemming inside each and every one of you dying to get out. Let it out. fact, you can divide the whole world of investors into three groups of lemmings. The first group I call proud lemmings. I'm a lemming and I'm proud to be a lemming. They call themselves momentum investors, but it's pretty much the same thing, right? What do? They look for a crowd and join in. You're buying, I'm buying. You're selling, I'm selling. Why are you buying? I don't care. I can't even imagine going up to somebody and saying, I'm a momentum investor. Might as well say, I'm a lemming and I'm proud to be a lemming. I'm really good at being a proud lemming. The second group of lemmings I call Yogi Bear lemmings. About 7 years ago, this is a movie, the Yogi Bear movie came out. In fact, my kids refused to go to it with me, but I went alone. Because I used to love those comics when I was a kid. And if you've ever read a Yogi Bear comic, his most famous saying was that he was smarter than the average bear. Yogi Bear lemmings think they're smarter than the average lemming. Here's what they want to do. They want to run with the crowd to the very edge of the cliff and last moment, veer away. Great if you can pull it off, right? You get all the upside of momentum and none of the downside. Admit it, you're tempted. You're saying, I'm smarter than the average lemming. I know where the cliff is coming. In case you're tempted to be a Yogi Bear lemming, I'd remind you of the immortal words of Stanley Druckenmiller. When he got fired, he was a George Soros, his portfolio manager in the late 90s. Made a big bet on tech stocks that went bad, and he got fired. Early 2000s. So at the press conference, he was asked, Mr. Druckenmiller, why did you buy all those tech stocks? You think they were cheap? He said, no, we knew they were overpriced when we bought them. So why did you buy them? So because we thought we could get out before the correction hit. In fact, he used some baseball terminology that can convert to football or soccer or whatever else you want. He said, we thought we were in the top of the eighth inning when, in fact, we were in the bottom of the ninth. Or as the Seattle Seahawks would like to say, we thought we were on the 8-yard line when, in fact, so that's it, you Seahawks, I don't want to kind of hit that sore spot. But basically, in lemming terminology, what he was saying, right? We thought we were 5 feet away from the cliff when, in fact, we were 5 feet past the cliff, at which point it turns out it was back there. And then gravity works its magic on you. I can't pull off being a proud lemming. I am definitely not smarter than the average lemming because I don't know where the cliff is. In fact, after every market correction, what do you see? Experts show up on CNBC and say, I saw that coming. So how come you never mentioned it? You were on CNBC every day for the last 4 years. It just slipped my mind. After the fact, it's always obvious. So if you ask me to describe myself, that's me. A lemming with a life vest. That's all you can aspire to be. You know what? Because you're human. You're going to be caught up in the mood of the moment. Don't tell me that you're completely immune to what's happening around you. All that valuation does, it throws your life away. It says, look, in addition to being held up by mood and perception, what other people think, hey, look at the cash flows. Look at what's holding up the stock. And sometimes it's good to look at what you're buying before you buy. I think all the time it's good to look at what you're buying before you buy. That's all valuation does. Do you really want to assume a growth rate of 80% for the next 10 years? I say, yes, okay, go buy it. That's all valuation is doing. 9 times out of 10, you're going to ignore what the valuation tells you, and you're going to do what you wanted in the first place anyway. Maybe that 1 time out of 10 is going to make a difference. So philosophically, here's what's driving valuation. What we're saying is, if you have an asset, a business, a company with cash flows, perception alone cannot sustain the price. It can drive the price for a long period. But perception alone can't set the price. As opposed to what? If you're buying a Picasso, it's all perception, right? If tomorrow we all collectively woke up and said, this guy can't paint, look, the nose is in the wrong place in every painting. Picasso, the face is all over the place, right? And he said, this is crap. And $5 million can be, it's all perception. If you're buying a collectible, it's all perception. So that A-Rod rookie card you bought for that extraordinarily high price, it's not worth much now. Unless you got taking steroids on the rookie card. You know. It's all perception. But if you're buying a business with cash flows, perception cannot be all that matters. And that's a big philosophical divide. If you talk to pure traders, you know what they say? Perception is all that matters. That's fine. That's a different... I believe that perception cannot be all that matters because there is an underlying value. In fact, it's a quote here from Henry Blodgett, Equity Research Report from early 2000, right? where he was talking about Internet Capital Group, a dot-com company of that time. He was trading at 174, and he said, basically, here's what he said. Valuation is often not a helpful tool in determining when to sell hypergrowth stocks. That's like saying whether you have a pulse or not is not that critical in telling me whether you're alive or dead. It doesn't make sense, but you can see the place it's coming from. So you get caught up in that perception is all that matters. You stop thinking about value. So I think ultimately value will matter. There's a reality check with companies with cash flows. Whether it happens in a year or three or five, we can debate, but there will be a check. And that's my philosophical belief. So I'm going to start with a question. Okay. Valuation as a discipline. I'd like you to tell me what word you would use to describe valuation as a discipline. I'm going to throw some words at you, and you tell me whether that word fits. Is valuation a science? Any engineers, scientists, mathematicians here? So you can be my science spokesperson. Is valuation a science? What's the essence of a science? And if you have a physical law, for instance, physical laws. Okay. So you're driven by the data, and you make a. So and if you have a law of physics, it's a law that applies to everybody. So if I jump out of the 10th floor of a building, law of gravity will work just as much on me as if a CEO jumps out of the 10th floor of a building. He can't say I'm an important guy, so hold gravity for me. And science is all about input-output, which is if you get the inputs right, you'll get the output right. Valuation is not a science. It's not even close. So it's not a science. You can get that out of the way. Is valuation an art? What's the essence of an art? You can't teach it. You either have it or you don't. Thank God valuation is not an art, or I've wasted 28 years of my life doing. Maybe it's magic. In the hands of some analysts, it does look like magic. It's not an art, it's not a science, it's not magic. What the heck is it? I'll give you my characterization for valuation. It's a craft. I'll give you an example of a craft. Cooking is a craft. How do you learn cooking? Not by watching cooking shows or YouTube videos or reading cookbooks, right? To learn cooking, what do you have to do? You have to cook. You've got to put the damn skillet. You've got to chop an onion. I remember the first time I was trying to make something. It said, whip the eggs up into this something, something. And I said, what the heck does that even mean? Right? You can whip it up so the eggs have this froth. It stands up on its own. I couldn't even visualize that. It took me like 2 days to do it. No, it took my wife 2 minutes to do it. But you learn cooking by doing. You learn carpentry by doing. Right? You can watch a YouTube video, but until you nail something in, you don't get it. You learn valuation by doing. So what I'm trying to say is this hour and 20 minutes you're spending here is really a waste of your time because I'm talking, you're listening, but you're not doing. So that's why I put up the valuation of the week and the weekly challenges, because if you really want to learn valuation, that's why you're in this class, and I hope that's why you're here. Then you learn it by doing. And the more companies you can value, not just the project company you pick, pick different companies. Okay? The greater your knowledge of it, you will learn what you don't know. That's the way I describe it. And there are layers to things you don't know, but until you run into them, you don't know what those layers are. Here's the other thing I want to bring up. I talked about narratives and numbers. So I'm going to ask you to kind of self-select here. How many of you would describe yourself as numbers people? You know what I mean? In high school, you loved the algebra class. You hated that history class. So let me ask you a question again. How many of you are numbers people? Okay. How many of you are stories people? And I think here's the problem you have in valuation. Right now, you have two camps. You have the numbers people on one mountaintop. You know, they've taken that training, the street class. They're Excel ninjas. They can write macros on top of macros on top of macros. They're very good at number crunching. And they think they have the high ground because they work with numbers all the time. The story people are the creative, you know, you run into them. They're creative people and they don't like numbers at all. They love telling stories and they don't like to be held accountable for their stories. So the story people are on their mountaintop saying, we're the creative people. We make the world go around. Those numbers people are geeks. And right now you have the two camps and they talk past each other. And once in a while you see this on CNBC, or you see a debate between a numbers person and a story. You don't even know what they're talking about because they're talking past each other. To me, valuation is a bridge between, a good valuation is a bridge between the numbers people and the story people. And I'll tell you what my end objective for this class is. If you're a numbers person, primarily, I want you to be a numbers person with imagination by the end of the class. The imagination to take that leap into things that might not be as easy to put into a number. And if you're a story person, I want you to have some discipline in your storytelling. And that's so a good valuation kind of brings together both skill sets. And that's why I put the Uber valuation, is for you to see the links. And I'll make a confession, I'm naturally a numbers person. That's where I'm most comfortable. So I've had to force myself to get more comfortable with the story side. And that's taken work. And it's still a work in progress. And part of the reason I enjoy valuing young growth companies is there the story comes first, the number comes later. If you're valuing just Procter & Gamble and Coca-Cola, you can be just a numbers person and get away with it. But if you're valuing younger companies where things are happening, you have to have a narrative that drives the valuation. So let me lay out some misconceptions about valuation. And at least I'll set the table and we'll come back to this. Here's the first one. Evaluation is an objective search for the truth, that you're some kind of scientist trying to estimate the value of companies. And what feeds into this is you sit in front of spreadsheets, you feed numbers, and afterwards I'm being objective. Look, with all numbers. Dispense with that delusion. All valuations are biased. The reason all valuations are biased is when you sit down to value a company, you come in with preconceptions about that company. And those preconceptions are going to find a way into your valuation. I'll give you a personal example. I valued Microsoft every year since 1986, since the year of their IPO. Every single time I valued Microsoft, I found it to be overvalued. You name the price, it was overvalued at that price. Strange, right? One of the great success stories of equity markets in the last part of the last century, I wouldn't have touched it one step of the way. Now, I could give you access to every single valuation of Microsoft I've done. And you could dig through the numbers looking for clues as to why I found it overvalued. But you'd be looking in the wrong place. If you really want to know why I found Microsoft overvalued, go up to the ninth floor. Go to 996. The door's actually open. Open the door. Walk in. Don't take anything with you when you leave. But look around you. You're going to be surrounded by computers. But every computer will have an Apple on its back. I've been an Apple user. In fact, if you stay in my office and turn around, there's a Mac 128 case sitting on top of my... For those of you who have never seen, that was the original Mac, which came without a hard drive. That was the first Mac that I got. I've been a Mac user since 1981. To me, Microsoft is the Darth Vader of technology. For those of you who are Star Wars fans, let me be more specific. I'm not talking Anakin Skywalker, Darth Vader. I'm talking Darth Vader, the guy who never takes a shower with the man. People wonder, does Darth Vader ever take a shower? What does he do? Yeah. I have a lot of bad thoughts about Bill Gates that open up every time I have to start a class because you know what button they ask me to hit to log on? Control-Alt-Delete. What kind of geek thinks that that's fun? Control-Alt-Delete. So basically, no one-handed person can ever log on, right? So that's already discrimination. The other is, what exactly is this accomplishing? Showing us how much better you are in writing this code than I am? So a lot of bad thoughts about Bill Gates. And every time I sit down to value Microsoft, those thoughts bubble up to the surface. Because in valuation, you constantly come to the forks in the road. Low growth or high growth. For me, Microsoft, it's a no-brainer. Low growth, who'd buy this rotten product? Low risk or high risk? One virus away from blowing up, or a high risk. Over the time I make my choices, the answer is obvious. I am far too biased to value Microsoft. And I need to know that. I need to know that because if I fool myself into thinking that I'm being objective, that I'm going to do stupid things like selling short on Microsoft, saying, how come the rest of the world doesn't agree with me? You know the other company that I'm far too biased to value is? I've kind of given away a clue. Apple. In fact, On my blog, if you followed it, I've been valuing Apple every 3 months since 2010. And the first, go back to the very first post, because half the post is about telling people not to trust my valuation. I said, don't trust my valuation. I love the company. I love its products way too much to be objective. But this is what I think about the valuation. And once in a while, I surprise myself because I find the company. So when I found Apple to be overvalued, it was a surprise to me because I was making every optimistic choice as I was going along. I said, hey, you know what? I'm still paying too much. And those are the valuations I have to listen to, because notwithstanding my biases, I'm getting a result that actually cuts in the opposite direction. So next session, what we're going to start with is I'm going to send you, or every class will start with a pre-class test. That sounds like a thing. But it's not a test that you're going to be graded on. We're going to be actually looking at something we'll be doing during the course of the class. And we'll take a test. And you're going to find out that most of the classes, you already know what the answer is to what we'll do in the class before we do it. So it'll actually be self-affirming as you take the test. So we'll start the class with a test about bias. And maybe I'll send it to you ahead of time so you can take a look at the list of potential valuations and where the bias is coming from. Okay, so I'll see you on Wednesday.